that the complex patterns of the cash box fingerprint could only belong to Alfred Stratton. The jury took just 2 hours to find the Stratton brothers guilty of murder, and the pair was sentenced to death by hanging, with justice swiftly dispatched on the 23rd of May. Take a look at your fingerprints now. There is seemingly endless complexity in the swirls and ridges. Since every human being carries different fingerprints on the hands and the soles of their feet, which aren't fingerprints but there isn't a word for them, the size of database required to characterize every human being's fingerprints would be colossal. One of the most important properties of nature, however, is that the blueprints for the construction of the natural world are far simpler than the natural world itself. In modern language, there is a tremendous amount of data compression going on. The instructions to create fingerprints are far simpler than the fingerprints themselves. And more than that, the same instructions run over and over again from slightly different starting points in the embryonic stage of our development always lead to different fingerprints. This behavior shouldn't come as a surprise. The sweep of desert dunes or the patterns in summer clouds are all described by a handful of simple laws governing how sand grains or water droplets behave when agitated by shifting air currents, buffeted by chaotic thermals and winds, and reordered by the action of the forces of nature. And yet from a simple recipe, complexity emerges. The quest to understand how the boundless variety of the natural world emerges from underlying simplicity has been a central theme in philosophical and scientific thought. Plato attempted to cast the world available to our senses as the distorted and imperfect shadow of an underlying reality of perfect forms accessible through reason alone. The modern expression of Plato's ethereal dualism was captured eloquently by Galileo 500 years ago. The book of nature is written in the language of mathematics. The challenge is not only to discern the underlying mathematical behavior of the world, but also to work back upwards along the chain of complexity, to explain how those forms that Plato would have defined as imperfect arise from the assumed lower level perfection. A rather beautiful early example of this quest is provided by Galileo's illustrious contemporary, Johannes Kepler. A brief history of the snowflake. Johannes Kepler is rightly best known for his laws of planetary motion that paved the way for Newton to write Principia. Hidden within his illustrious CV, however, is a publication that had a rather more whimsical, earthbound ambition. 2 years after publishing the first part of Astronomia Nova in 1609, Kepler published a short 24-page paper entitled De Nive Sexangula, on the six-cornered snowflake. It is a beautiful example of a curious scientific mind at work. In the dark December of 1610, Kepler was walking across the Charles Bridge in Prague when a snowflake fell on the lapel of his coat. In the freezing night, he stopped and wondered why this ephemeral sliver of ice possessed a six-sided structure in common with all other snowflakes, notwithstanding their seemingly infinite variation. Others had noticed this symmetry before, but Kepler realized that the symmetry of a snowflake must be a reflection of the deeper natural processes that underlie its formation. Since it always happens when it begins to snow that the first particles of snow adopt the shape of small six-cornered stars, there must be a particular cause, wrote Kepler. For if it happened by chance, why would they always fall with six corners and not with five or seven? Kepler hypothesized that this symmetry must be due to the nature of the fundamental building blocks of snowflakes. This stacking of frozen globules, as he referred to it, must be the most efficient way of building a snowflake from the smallest natural unit of a liquid like water. To my mind, this is a leap of genius, and a tremendously modern way of thinking about physics. The study of symmetry in nature lies at the very heart of the standard model, and abstract symmetries known as gauge symmetries are now known to be the origin of the forces of nature. This is why the force-carrying particles in the Standard Model are known as gauge bosons. Kepler was searching for the atomic structure of snow before we knew atoms existed, motivated by the observation of a symmetry in nature, the six-sided shape of all snowflakes. The inspiration for this idea, which is way ahead of its time, came from a peculiar source. In the years leading up to the publication of De Nive Sexangula, Kepler had been in communication with Thomas Harriot, an English mathematician and explorer. Amongst multiple claims to fame, Harriot was the navigator on one of Sir Walter Raleigh's voyages to the New World, and had been asked to solve a seemingly simple mathematical problem. Raleigh wanted to know how best to stack cannonballs to make the most efficient use of the limited space on the ship's deck. Harriot was driven to explore the mathematical principles of sphere packing, which in turn led him to develop an embryonic model of atomic theory and inspire Kepler's consideration of the structure of snowflakes. Kepler imagined replacing cannonballs with globules of ice and supposed that the most efficient arrangement creating the greatest density of globules was the six-sided hexagonal form he observed in the snowflake on his shoulder. Kepler also observed hexagonal structures across the natural world, from beehives to pomegranates and snowflakes, and presumed that there must be some deeper reason for its ubiquity. Hexagonal packing, as Kepler referred to it, must be the tightest possible, so that in no other arrangement could more pellets be stuffed into the same container. This became known as the Kepler conjecture. It took almost 400 years to prove Kepler's conjecture, and this required the help of a 1990s supercomputer. Despite the time lag, Kepler's work had a more immediate impact, inspiring the beginnings of modern crystallography that led eventually to the discovery of the structure of DNA. What a lovely example of serendipity coupled with curiosity and a sprinkling of genius. From cannonballs to snowflakes to the code of life. As for Kepler's original thought on that frozen bridge, he never found the connection between the underlying structure of his ice globules and the hexagonal symmetry of snowflakes. Even though he realized that the regular patterns must reveal something about the shape of the building blocks of snowflakes and the details of the packing, he couldn't explain the ornate complexity or the flatness of the structure. Instead, he acknowledged his failure with the good grace of a true scientist. "I have knocked on the doors of chemistry," he writes at the end of his paper, "and seeing how much remains to be said on this subject before we know the cause, I would rather hear what you think, my most ingenious man, than wear myself out with further discussion." 3.5 centuries later, Japanese physicist Yukichiro Nakayara made the first artificial snowflakes in a laboratory. Writing in 1954, he describes a process that begins not with the snowflake itself, but with smaller substructures called snow crystals, which are in turn built up from collections of ice crystals, the globules Kepler was searching for. The hexagonal packing that Kepler suspected to be the origin of the snowflake symmetry begins with the formation of these ice crystals, when water molecules link together in a hexagonal structure via hydrogen bonds. Hydrogen bonding occurs because of the structure of the water molecules themselves, with a greedy oxygen atom hungry for electrons grabbing them off two hydrogen atoms, forming covalent bonds that lock the H2O molecules together, leaving a residual positive electrical charge in the vicinity of the two protons and a negative charge in the vicinity of the oxygen. This slight separation of charge in the water molecules allows them to bind together into larger structures through the mutual attraction and repulsion of the electrical charges, just as an electron is bound into its position around an atomic nucleus. The entire configuration, including the structure of the oxygen nucleus and the single protons that comprise the hydrogen nuclei, can be predicted in principle by the Standard Model of particle physics. Yet the details of any particular snowflake are beyond computation, because the seemingly infinite variety reflects the precise history of the snowflake itself. Once ice crystals form as agglomerations of water molecules held together by hydrogen bonds, they cluster around dust particles in the air, building on their underlying hexagonal symmetry to form larger snow crystals. As the crystals begin the long journey down to Earth, They join in ever larger, more complex combinations, shaped by endless variations of air temperature, wind patterns, and humidity, into myriad unique forms. The symmetry is all that remains of the simplicity, and it takes a careful and patient eye to see the endless variation for what it is, a reflection of the complex history of the snowflake, convoluted with the underlying simplicity of the laws of nature. The most vivid example of emergent complexity, and the closest to our hearts, is life. As we discussed in Chapter 2, the origin of life on Earth has a sense of inevitability about it, because its basic processes are chemical reactions that will proceed given the right conditions. Those conditions were present in the oceans of Earth 3.8 billion years ago, possibly earlier, and they led to the emergence of single-celled organisms. The fateful encounter which produced the eukaryotic cell around 2 billion years ago looks rather more like blind chance, but it happened here and laid the foundations for the Cambrian explosion 530 million years ago. There is a bit of hand-waving going on here, though, and to make a more persuasive case that all the complexity of Darwin's endless forms most beautiful can at least in principle emerge from simple underlying laws, one more example is in order. Perhaps the most beautiful manifestation of the artful complexity of nature can be found in the spots, stripes, and patterns on the coats and skin of living things. Emergent pattern writ large across venomous striped surgeonfish, emperor angelfish, zebra swallow-tailed butterflies, and the big cats of Africa and Asia. Everyone agrees that these patterns evolved as a result of natural selection of one form or another, and the raw material for the variation was provided by random mutations in the genetic code. But a very challenging scientific question of fundamental importance in modern biology is precisely how patterns such as these appear. How the leopard got its spots. Zebra moved away to some little thorn bushes where the sunlight fell all stripy, and the giraffe moved off to some tallish trees where the shadows fell all blotchy. "Now watch," said the zebra and the giraffe. "This is the way it's done. One, two, three, and where's your breakfast?" All they could see were stripy shadows and blotched shadows in the forest, but never a sign of zebra and giraffe. "That's a trick worth learning. Take a lesson from it, leopard." Then the Ethiopian put his five fingers close together and pressed them all over the leopard, and wherever the five fingers touched, they left five black marks all close together. Rudyard Kipling's Just So story, How the Leopard Got His Spots, tells the story of an Ethiopian man and a leopard. They went hunting together, but one day the man noticed that the leopard wasn't very successful. The reason, he deduced, was that the leopard had a plain, sandy coat, whereas all the other animals had camouflage. "That's a trick worth learning, leopard," he said, taking his fingers and thumb and pressing them into the leopard's coat to give it the distinctive five-pointed pattern. If you don't believe in evolution by natural selection, this is the most plausible theory open to you. If you do, then what remains is to identify the mechanism by which the pattern is formed. The answer might appear to be solely a matter of genetics, but genes are not the whole story. It would take a terrific amount of information to instruct every single cell to colour itself according to its position on the leopard's skin, and this is indeed not what is done. Nature is frugal and deploys a much more efficient mechanism for producing camouflage patterns. As with so many things in this book, I get to say yet again that this is an active area of research, and therefore exciting. The reason for the attention is that camouflage patterns on the skin self-organize during the development of the embryo, and embryonic development is, of course, fundamental to an understanding of biology. In the case of the leopard, it is thought, though not proven, that the camouflage is an example of a Turing pattern, named after the great Bletchley Park codebreaker and mathematician Alan Turing. In 1952, Turing became interested in morphogenesis, the process by which an animal develops its shape and patterning. He was particularly interested in the mathematics behind regularly repeating patterns in nature, such as the Fibonacci numbers and golden ratio in the leaf arrangements of plants and the scales of pineapples, and the appearance of camouflage patterns such as the tiger's stripes and the leopard's spots. Turing's influential and groundbreaking paper, The Chemical Basis of Morphogenesis, published in March 1952, begins with a simple statement. It is suggested that a system of chemical substances called morphogens, reacting together and diffusing through a tissue, is adequate to account for the main phenomena of morphogenesis. These systems are known as reaction-diffusion systems, and they can produce patterns from a featureless initial mixture if the two reactants diffuse at different speeds. There's a nice analogy that describes how such a system can work. This analogy was published by J.D. Murray in Notices of the AMS, June-July 2012, Why Are There No Three-Headed Monsters? Mathematical Modelling in Biology. Imagine a dry field full of grasshoppers. They are strange grasshoppers because when they get warm, they sweat, generating a large amount of moisture. Now imagine that the field is set alight in several different places. The flames will spread at some fixed speed, and if there were no grasshoppers, the whole field would be charred. As the flames approach the grasshoppers, however, they will start to sweat, dampening the grass behind them and inhibiting the flames as they hop away ahead of the approaching flames. Depending on the different parameters, including the different speeds of the flames and the grasshoppers and the amount of sweat necessary to quell the advancing flames, a Turing pattern can be formed, with areas of charred grass and green areas where the inhibiting grasshoppers prevented the fire from taking hold. It is thought that the leopard gets its spots in this way during embryonic development. An activator chemical, fire, spreads through the skin and stimulates the production of the dark pigmented spots, charred grass, but is inhibited by another chemical, sweating grasshoppers, spreading with a higher diffusion rate. The precise pattern produced depends on the constants of nature of the system, such as the speeds at which the chemicals diffuse, and on what a mathematician would call the boundary conditions, the size and geometry of the grassy field in our analogy. In embryonic development, it is the size and shape of the embryo when the reaction diffusion begins that determines the type of pattern produced. A long and thin domain produces stripes. A domain that is too small or too large produces uniform color. In between can be found the distinctive coat patterns of cows, giraffe, cheetah, and of course the leopard. Computer simulations of Turing patterns have been remarkably successful, not only in describing the generic features, particularly of mammalian coats, but also of some of the interesting details seen in nature. For example, the mathematical models predict that it is possible for spotted animals to have striped tails, as cheetahs do, but not for striped animals to have spotted tails, and indeed no such examples exist. Kepler's snowflakes and the leopard's spots are two picturesque examples of emergent complexity, the appearance of intricate, ordered patterns from the action of simple underlying laws. Nature contains systems far more complex than these, of course, you being a case in point. But to return to the question at the beginning of our solipsistic meander, the reason that you exist, given the laws of nature, is that you are allowed to. Just as all snowflakes and all leopards' coats are unique in detail because of their individual formation histories, so you are unique because no two human beings share a common history. But we wouldn't read any deep meaning into the existence of one particular snowflake in a snowstorm, and the same is true for you. Our focus should therefore shift from trying to explain the appearance of humans or our planet or even our galaxy to a rather deeper question, the origin of the whole framework, of space-time and the laws that govern it and the allowed structures within it. What properties of the laws themselves are essential for galaxies, planets and human beings to exist? After all, as we've noted, the laws might be mathematically elegant and economical, but they do contain a whole host of seemingly randomly chosen numbers discovered by experimental observation and with no known rhyme or reason to them. The constants of nature, such as the strength of the forces, the masses of the particles, and the amount of dark energy in the universe. How dependent is our existence on these fundamental numbers? A universe made for us. Our universe appears to be made for us. We live on a perfect planet, orbiting around a perfect star. This is, of course, content-free whimsy. The argument is backwards. We have to be a perfect fit for the planet because we evolved on it. But there are interesting questions when we look deeper into the laws of nature and ask what properties they must have to support a life in the universe. Take the existence of stars, for example. Stars like the Sun burn hydrogen into helium in their cores. This process involves all four forces of nature working together. Gravity kicks it all off by causing clouds of dust and gas to collapse. As the clouds collapse, they get denser and hotter until the conditions are just right for nuclear fusion to occur. Fusion starts by turning protons into neutrons through the action of the weak nuclear force. The strong nuclear force binds the protons and neutrons together into a helium nucleus, which in itself exists on account of the delicate balance between the strong nuclear force holding it together and the electromagnetic force trying to blow it apart because of electrically charged protons. When stars run out of hydrogen fuel, they perform another series of equally precarious nuclear reactions to build carbon, oxygen, and the other heavy elements essential for the existence of life. What happens if the strength of these forces, those fundamental constants of nature we met earlier in the chapter, are varied a bit? There are many examples of apparent fine-tuning in nature. If protons were 0.2% more massive, then they would be unstable and decay into neutrons. That would certainly put an end to life in the universe because there would be no atoms. The proton mass is ultimately set by the details of the strong and electromagnetic forces and by the masses of the constituent quarks, which are set by the Yukawa couplings to the Higgs field in the Standard Model. There really isn't much freedom at all. The mother of all fine tunes, however, is the value of our old friend dark energy, the thing that is causing our universe to gently accelerate in its expansion. Although dark energy contributes 68% of the energy density of the universe, the amount of dark energy in a given volume of space is actually small, very small, 10 to the minus 27 kilograms per cubic meter, to be precise. The point is that every cubic meter of our universe has this amount of dark energy in it, and that adds up. Explaining why dark energy has this small but non-zero value is one of the great problems in cosmology, not least because if a particle physicist sits down with a quantum field theory and decides to calculate how big it should be, it turns out that it would be more naturally of the order of 10 to the 97 kilograms per cubic meter. That's a lot bigger than 10 to the minus 27 kilograms per cubic meter. Over a million, 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 million times bigger, in fact. That's embarrassing for the particle physicists, of course, but from the perspective of fine-tuning, it's even worse. If the value of dark energy were only 50 times larger than it is in our universe, rather than somewhere else in this immensely large theoretical range, then it would have become dominant in the universe around 1 billion years after the Big Bang, during the time that the first galaxies were forming. Because dark energy acts to accelerate the universe's expansion and dilute matter and dark matter, gravity would have lost the battle in such a universe, and no galaxies or stars or planets or life would exist. What could possibly account for this incredible piece of luck? It can't really be luck. The odds are too long by a Jeffrey Boycott innings. One possibility is that there is some as yet unknown physical law or symmetry that guarantees that the amount of dark energy will be very close to, but not quite, zero. This is certainly possible, and there are physicists who believe that this may be the case. The other possibility, which was raised by one of the fathers of the Standard Model, Steven Weinberg, is that the value of dark energy is anthropically selected. Anthropic arguments appear at one level to be a statement of the obvious. The properties of the universe must be such that human beings can exist because human beings do exist. This is, of course, true, but it is fairly devoid of content from a physical perspective, unless there is some way in which all possible values of dark energy, and indeed all the other constants of nature, are realized somewhere. If, for example, there exists a vast, possibly infinite swathe of different domains in the universe, or indeed an infinity of other universes, each with a different amount of dark energy selected by some mechanism from the span of allowed values, then we would indeed have a valid anthropic explanation for our special human universe. It must exist because they all do, and of course we appear in the one that permits our existence. But surely it makes no sense to take refuge in a vast infinity of universes to explain our existence. Absolutely correct, if that's why the idea is introduced. It's no better than a God of the Gaps explanation. If, however, there was some other reason, based on observations and theoretical understanding, that suggested an infinity of universes, then such an anthropic explanation for our perfect human universe would be admissible. Remarkably, and that remarkably overused word is appropriate for once, this outlandish suggestion is a widely held view amongst many cosmologists. A day without yesterday. If we look at our universe on the largest distance scales, by which I mean at distance scales far larger than the size of single galaxies, it has a number of properties that any theory of its origin has to explain. The most precise picture of the young universe we have is the photograph of the cosmic microwave background radiation, CMB, taken by the Planck satellite. This is the afterglow of the Big Bang, a photograph of the universe as it was 380,000 years after the initial hot, dense phase, when the expansion had cooled things down sufficiently for atoms to form. The most obvious feature of the CMB is that it's extremely uniform, glowing at a temperature of 2.72548 degrees above absolute zero, with small fluctuations at the level of one part in 100,000. Those very tiny temperature differences are represented by the colours in the photograph. This uniformity is extremely difficult to explain in the standard Big Bang model, for a simple reason. Our observable universe today is 90 billion light-years across. This means that if we look out to the CMB from opposite sides of the Earth, we are looking at two glowing parts of the ancient sky that are now separated by 90 billion light-years. The universe, however, is only 13.8 billion years old, which means that light, the fastest thing there is, has only had time to travel 13.8 billion light-years. Two opposite parts of the CMB could therefore never have been in contact with each other in the standard Big Bang model, and there is absolutely no reason why they should be almost precisely the same temperature. I've emphasized almost in the previous sentence because, as we noted, there are very slight variations in the CMB at the level of one part in 100,000, and these are very important. The universe was never completely smooth and uniform everywhere, and these variations in density are encoded into the CMB as differences in temperature. The regions of slightly greater density ultimately seeded the formation of the galaxies, and so without them, we wouldn't exist. What caused these small variations in the otherwise ultra-smooth early universe? Another fundamental property of the universe that is difficult to explain is its curvature, or lack of it, which can also be measured from the CMB. Space appears to be absolutely flat, a veritable ice rink. Recall from Chapter 1 that the shape of space is related to the density and distribution of matter and energy in the universe through Einstein's equations. In the standard Big Bang theory, the universe doesn't have to be flat. In fact, it requires a great deal of fine-tuning to keep it flat over 13.8 billion years of cosmic evolution. Instead, the radius of curvature is measured to be much greater than the radius of the observable universe, more than 60 orders of magnitude larger. That's a big problem. In the early 1980s, the need to explain these and other properties of the observable universe led a group of Russian and American physicists to propose a radical idea. The modern version, the best-known proponents of which are Alan Guth, André Linde, and Alexei Starobinsky, is known as the theory of inflation. We'll describe a particular version of inflation below, driven by something called a scalar field, which was first described by André Linde. Space-time existed before the Big Bang, and for at least some of that time was described by Einstein's theory of general relativity and a quantum field theory like the Standard Model. The central idea in quantum theory is that anything that can happen does happen. Everything that is not explicitly ruled out by the laws of nature will happen given enough time. One of the types of things permitted to exist in quantum field theory are scalar fields. We've met an example of a scalar field earlier in the chapter in the guise of the Higgs field, which we know to exist because we've measured it at the Large Hadron Collider. Scalar fields have the property that they can cause space to expand exponentially fast. We touched on such a scenario in Chapter 1 without being explicit about the mechanism. It is the de Sitter's matterless solution to Einstein's field equations first discovered in 1917. Given general relativity and quantum field theory, therefore, it must be the case that scalar fields will fluctuate into existence in such a way that an exponential expansion of space-time is triggered. In this exponential phase, space-time expands faster than the speed of light. This might sound problematic if you know some relativity, but it isn't. The universal speed limit exists for particles moving through space-time, but does not apply for the expansion of space-time itself. In a tiny fraction of a second, around 10 to the minus 35 seconds, in fact, an exponential expansion of this type can inflate a piece of space-time as tiny as the Planck length to a quite mind-boggling size, trillions of times larger than the observable universe. Any pre-existing curvature is completely washed out, leading to a flat observable universe. It's like looking at a square centimetre-sized piece of the surface of a balloon of a light year in radius. You won't see any curvature, no matter how hard you try. Likewise, any variations in density will be washed out, leading to the smooth and uniform appearance of the CMB. Perhaps the greatest triumph of inflationary models such as these, however, is that they don't predict a completely uniform, homogeneous, and isotropic universe. Quantum theory doesn't allow for absolute uniformity. Empty space is never empty, but a fizzing, shifting soup of all possible quantum fields. Like the surface of a stormy ocean, waves in the fields are constantly rising and falling, and the exponential expansion can freeze these undulations into the universe. Remarkably, when calculations using the known laws of quantum theory are carried out, the sort of density fluctuations that result from such a mechanism are precisely of the form seen in the CMB. These quantum fluctuations are the seeds of the galaxies, and therefore the seeds of our existence, frozen into the oldest light in the cosmos and photographed by a satellite built by the people of Earth 13.8 billion years later. Inflation in this guise explains the observable properties of our universe, and in particular all the details of the CMB, which has been measured to high accuracy. This is why it is currently widely accepted as an essential ingredient by many cosmologists. As if this wasn't enough to get excited about, however, there is much more. One obvious question that arises is this: if inflation gets going, how does it stop? The answer is that inflation stops completely naturally, but with a fascinating twist that drives right to the heart of our "why are we here" question. The scalar field driving inflation fluctuates up and down in accord with the laws of quantum theory, just like the waves on the surface of an ocean. If the energy stored in the field is high enough, inflation begins. One might expect that such a rapid expansion would dilute the energy extremely rapidly, causing inflation to stop. But scalar fields have the interesting property that their energy density can stay relatively constant as space expands. You can think of the expanding space as doing work on the field, pumping energy into it and keeping its level high. And in turn, the high level of the field's energy continues to drive the expansion. This might sound like the ultimate free lunch, and in a sense it is, almost, although gradually the energy will become diluted and decay away. The time this takes depends on the size of the initial fluctuation in the field and the details of the field itself. But in general, the higher the initial energy, the longer the field takes to fall in value as the expansion continues. An analogy often used to picture this scenario is to imagine a ball rolling down the side of a valley. The height of the ball up the valley side represents the energy density of the scalar field. When the ball is high up, the energy in the field is high, driving the inflationary expansion. As the ball rolls slowly down the valley, the energy reduces and inflation turns off. At the valley floor, the ball oscillates back and forth until it comes to rest. The scalar field likewise oscillates, and in doing so, dumps its energy into the universe in the form of particles. In so doing, it creates a hot, dense soup, which we identify as the Big Bang. In other words, inflation ends naturally, and the standard Big Bang follows. The decay of the scalar field that drove inflation is the cause of the Big Bang. Let us step back a moment and recap with broad brushstrokes, because we seem to be wandering onto Leibniz's territory, and that's an astonishing place for physics to have arrived at. Our claim is that there exists a quantum field that causes the universe to expand exponentially fast for some period of time, and in doing so, produces all the features of the universe we observe today, including the existence of galaxies and the matter out of which they are made. This is a triumph, and is now part of cosmology textbooks. Before the Big Bang, there was inflation. Fine, our philosopher friends would say. But what happened before inflation? Here, we must leave the textbooks and become a little more speculative, but not too speculative. We're still going to be working within the domain of mainstream physics. There is an extension of what we might term standard inflationary theory. It's known as eternal inflation. Put simply, there seems to be no reason why inflation should stop everywhere at the same time. There should always be regions of the universe where the scalar field fluctuates to such high values that the exponential expansion continues. And these regions will always come to dominate the universe, however rare they may be, because they are exponentially expanding. Where inflation stops, Big Bangs herald the beginning of more sedately expanding regions like ours. But elsewhere, there is an ever-growing, exponentially expanding universe, constantly spawning an infinity of Big Bangs. This theory, known as eternal inflation, leads to an infinite, immortal multiverse, growing fractal-like without end. This is truly mind-numbing, but we must emphasize that it is an entirely natural extension of standard inflationary cosmology. Eternal inflation opens up even more exciting possibilities. As we discussed above, one of the great mysteries in physics today is the origin of the constants of nature, such as the strength of gravity, the masses of the particles, and the value of dark energy. These values appear to be fine-tuned for the existence of life, and understanding where they come from is a prerequisite for understanding our existence. In eternal inflationary models, each mini-universe can have different values of these constants and different effective laws of physics. The word effective is important. The idea is that there is some overarching framework out of which our laws and the constants of nature are selected randomly. If this is correct, then each of the infinite number of mini-universes that branch off the fractal inflationary multiverse can have different effective laws of physics, and all possible combinations will be realized somewhere. No matter how fine-tuned our laws appear for the existence of life, it is inevitable that such mini-universes as ours will exist, and there will be an infinite number of each possible set of combinations. There is no fine-tuning problem. Given the multiverse, we are inevitable. This is reminiscent of our rejection of your own personal uniqueness whilst listening to Joy Division at the beginning of the chapter. Yes, in isolation, the odds of you existing are almost vanishingly small. But given a mechanism for producing human beings, babies are born all the time and their existence is not surprising. Here, we have a mechanism for producing universes, And with an even greater statistical sledgehammer, the mechanism doesn't simply produce a few billion of them. It produces a potentially infinite number. This is a quite stunning theoretical model, and I understand that it sounds like wild speculation. It isn't, though. Inflation is probably correct in some form, in the sense that before what we call the Big Bang, there was an exponential expansion of space-time. Scalar fields, which are known to exist, have the correct properties to drive such an expansion, although there are other theoretical models of inflation as well. Theoretical physicists studying inflationary models have discovered that almost all of them are eternal, in the sense that they stop inflating in patches rather than all at once. This means that the potential for creating universes in the guise of inflation is always expanding faster than it is decaying away, and it will therefore never stop. We live in an infinite, eternal, fractal multiverse, comprised of an infinite number of universes like ours, alongside an infinite number of universes with different physical laws. We exist because it is inevitable. Almost. There is one very important caveat to this picture. Recent research suggests that eternal inflationary models may be eternal in the future, but not in the past. They never stop, but they may have to start. I can't give you a definitive answer to this ultimate question because nobody yet knows. I can quote from André Linder's recent review of inflationary cosmology, Inflationary Cosmology After Planck, 2013. In other words, there was a beginning for each part of the universe, and there will be an end for inflation at any particular point. But there will be no end for the evolution of the universe as a whole in the eternal inflation scenario. And at present, we do not know whether there was a single beginning of the evolution of the universe as a whole at some moment t equals zero, which was traditionally associated with the Big Bang. And so we reach the end. Defining the Big Bang as the initial hot, dense phase of our observable universe that gave rise to the CMB 380,000 years later, we understand what happened before. There was a period of inflationary expansion, which could have been driven by a scalar field in accord with the known laws of physics. That inflationary expansion is probably still going on somewhere, spawning an incalculable number of universes as we speak, and it will continue doing this forever. We live in an eternal universe in which everything that can happen does happen. And we are one of the things that can happen. Did the whole universe have a beginning, an essential external cause in the spirit of Leibniz's God? We still don't know. Possibly there was a mother of all big bangs? And if so, we will certainly need a quantum theory of gravity to say anything more. What does this mean? The wonderful thing for me is that nobody knows, because the philosophical and indeed theological consequences of eternal inflation have not been widely debated and discussed. My hope is that in trying to summarize the issues, regrettably briefly and necessarily superficially in the television series, and in a little more depth here, these ideas will be accessible to a wider audience and stimulate discussion. This is desirable and necessary, because ideas are the lifeblood of civilization, and societies assimilate ideas and become comfortable with their implications through understanding and debate. If eternal inflation is the correct description of our universe, it will be the artists, philosophers, theologians, novelists, and musicians, alongside the physicists, who explore its meaning. What does it mean if the existence of our universe is inevitable? What does it mean if we are not special in any way? What does it mean if our observable universe, with all its myriad galaxies and possibilities, is a vanishingly small leaf on an ever-expanding fractal tree of universes? What does it mean if you are because you have to be? I can't tell you. I can only ask, what does it mean to you? For small creatures such as we, the vastness is bearable only through love. Carl Sagan. Chapter 5. What is our future? I can hardly wait to see you come of age, but I guess we'll both just have to be patient, because it's a long way to go, a hard row to hoe. Yes, it's a long way to go. But in the meantime, before you cross the street, take my hand. Life is what happens to you while you're busy making other plans. John Lennon. Making the darkness visible. They must have descended into the darkness for a reason. Their burning dry grass torches would have filled the caverns with acrid smoke, sucking the oxygen from the wet air. They would have moved carefully, fearfully perhaps, enveloped in a dim, flickering sphere of red, fading into a profound, silent dark, the like of which I don't experience. A child held her hand against the rock and blew a red pigmented mixture across it with a straw. She smiled. My hand. Her companions reached into the pigment and in careful movements inked a line of dots beside the handprint. The precision of a young imagination. A retreat into the lightness of the cave mouth. Perhaps we'll come back some day, she thought. Over 40,800 years later, I held my hand next to hers, because the experts on the Upper Paleolithic told me that the handprints are always those of children, and most likely always female. El Castillo in northern Spain contains some of the oldest cave art in the world. It is not known precisely how old, because the pigments themselves cannot be dated. The art is covered in calcite, which dripped and crystallized across the handprints and dots, as the whole of recorded history played out above. Calcite contains uranium-234 atoms, which decay with a half-life of 245,000 years into thorium-230, which in turn decays with a half-life of 75,000 years. Thorium is not soluble in water, so there was none when the limestone formed. By measuring the concentrations of the uranium isotopes 234 and 238 and the thorium 230, a precise date for the formation of the calcite can be measured. This gives a minimum date for the art, since of course it must have been created before it was covered. The limestone covering the red dots formed 40,800 years ago. The oldest handprint was covered 37,300 years ago. These dates are significant because before 41,000 years ago, there is no evidence of modern humans in Europe. Homo sapiens arrived tantalizingly close to the minimum age of the art in the darkness of El Castillo, leading some anthropologists to suggest that the art is not human. Rather, it might have been created by our close cousins, the Neanderthals, who dominated Europe at the time. I find this possibility profoundly interesting and moving. It's interesting because the creators of this art had all the attributes that we might lazily refer to as uniquely human. The retreat into the deep caves was undoubtedly a sophisticated response to the world. This is not mere decoration, because cave art like this is not found near the cave entrances where these people lived. Its creation is highly ritualized. The darkness is integral. One of the most beautiful pieces in El Castillo is a bison, half carved out of a column of rock and shaded with pigments to emphasize the arch of its back. When illuminated by torchlight, the rock casts a flickering animal shadow onto the cave wall. The interaction of light and dark was important to the rituals carried out here before history, perhaps before humans. The cave resonates with ideas, curiosities, and fears. It represents a border, the transition from existence to living. If this is a human place, it's a record of the first stumbling steps towards humanity. But if it is Neanderthal, it is a record of an ending, an ascent cut short. Perhaps we'll come back someday, thought the little girl in my imagination. Not long afterwards, her species became extinct, outcompeted by their incoming cousins. Perhaps. It is possible that the date coincides with the migration of Homo sapiens into Europe because the art is indeed human. Some anthropologists believe that the art may have been a response to the native Neanderthal population, a sort of prehistoric shock and awe, asserting cultural dominance and engendering a sense of community and superiority in the nascent human population. Things never change. If this is the case, the Neanderthals inadvertently played a role in our ascent. The roles may have been reversed, however. Perhaps our ancestors found a young, emerging, and more sophisticated culture when they crossed the Mediterranean. A species distantly related to us, whose desire to explore the darkness we assimilated. Perhaps our intellectual climb was, in part, a response to them. Intellectual superiority does not guarantee survival. Witness the fall of classical civilization. This possibility is illustrative of a fact, that we modern humans often subconsciously rest in the shadows. Things can end forever. Species become extinct, and that doesn't only apply to animals with feathers and no feelings. The Neanderthals became extinct, and they may have begun to imagine a future before they lost it. The red handprints of El Castillo are overwhelming in this context. Go there. Hold your hand up to hers. Hear the giggles. Picture the smiles. Imagine the beginnings of hope. And listen to the silence. At least 40,800 years later, we can use our knowledge of nuclear physics to move backwards through time to piece together her story. Science is a time machine, and it goes both ways. We are able to predict our future with increasing certainty. Our ability to act in response to these predictions will ultimately determine our fate. Science and reason make the darkness visible. I worry that lack of investment in science and a retreat from reason may prevent us from seeing further, or delay our reaction to what we see, making a meaningful response impossible. There are no simple fixes. Our civilization is complex. Our global political system is inadequate. Our internal differences of opinion are deep-seated. I'd bet you think you're absolutely right about some things and virtually everyone else is an idiot. Climate change? Europe? God? America? The monarchy? Same-sex marriage? Abortion? Big business? Nationalism? The United Nations? The bank bailout? Tax rates? Genetically modified crops? Eating meat, football, X Factor or Strictly? The way forward is to understand and accept that there are many opinions, but only one human civilization, only one nature, and only one science. The collective goal of ensuring that there is never less than one human civilization must surely override our personal prejudices. At least we have come far enough in 40,800 years to be able to state the obvious. And this is a necessary first step. We've woken up at the wheel of the bus and realized we don't know how to drive it. Sudden impact. On the 15th of February 2013 at 9:13 a.m., a 12,000-ton asteroid entered Earth's atmosphere traveling at 60 times the speed of sound. It came from the direction of the sun, so there was never any chance of seeing its approach. The rock broke up at an altitude of 29 kilometers, depositing over 20 times the energy of the Hiroshima bomb into the sky above the Russian town of Chelyabinsk. Thousands of buildings were damaged by the shockwave, and 1,500 people were injured mainly by flying glass, as windows smashed in multiple cities across the region. Sound waves from the explosion rattled around the globe twice and were detected by a nuclear weapons monitoring station in the Antarctic. The Russian Parliament's Foreign Affairs Committee chief, Alexei Pushkov, took to Twitter. "Instead of fighting on Earth, people should be creating a joint system of asteroid defense." Naive idealism? Overreaction? Hollywood? Not really. 16 hours later, a 40,000-ton asteroid named 367943 Duende streaked by at an altitude of 27,200 kilometers, well within the orbits of many of our satellites, although it missed them all. This one had a name, because it was discovered by astronomers in Spain in 2012. There is a 1 in 3,000 chance that Duende will strike the Earth before 2069. If it does, it could destroy a city, which isn't too bad. Before Chelyabinsk, the last recorded large impact was the Tunguska event over Siberia in 1908. The shockwave created by the airburst flattened 2,000 square kilometers of forest in an energy release close to that of the United States' most powerful hydrogen bomb test at Bikini Atoll in March 1954. Events on this scale are thought to occur on average once every 300 years and could easily wipe out a densely populated region. The best-known impact in popular culture was the Chicxulub event in Mexico's Yucatan Peninsula 66 million and 38,000 plus or minus 11,000 years ago, which wiped out the non-avian dinosaurs. Precision is important when available.